Hello from Gilbert and Tobin. I'm Moya Dodd.
And I'm Matt Rubenstein, and this is The Competitive Edge, what you need to know about competition law in Australia and around the world.
Today, kicking off, partner Ilona Miller and Business and Human Rights Lawyers Association co-chair Ray Lindsay joined me at a forum we held to talk ESG, sport and human rights.
We've heard a lot about the importance of looking at the relationship between a company and its stakeholders and not just its investors and shareholders. Ultimately, what a company is doing when it starts to really take into account the interests of its stakeholders is looking at how it will actually drive mutually beneficial relationships that will ultimately deliver financial value as well as impact value for the company.
But first, Matt, what's been happening around the grounds?
Well, the debate around the merger approval process seems to be coming to the crunch, and there are a couple of developments that might make a difference as the government decides which way it wants to go.
Well, top of that list would be the Australian Competition Tribunal overturning the ACCC, which had refused to authorise ANZ's acquisition of the Suncorp banking business after conducting a limited merits review.
Exactly right. This is the kind of process that the ACCC is arguing should apply to all mergers that meet size or turnover requirements. So there's a lot of interest in these decisions.
Yeah, so the ACCC refused to authorise that merger because it thought it would increase the likelihood of coordination across the market for home loans.
Yeah, it said that ANZ is the smallest of the big four banks and buying Suncorp would make it more like the other three. If it stayed the way it was and had to compete with Suncorp as it is now or merged with another buyer, that would be a more interesting and more competitive market.
So the parties appealed to the tribunal, which is a limited merits review, and that means that, with a few exceptions, the tribunal can only look at the material that was before the ACCC. We heard about that from Simon and Elizabeth in the last episode.
Yeah, and they said that that was a frustration for the parties in the Telstra and TPG review, where they felt that they didn't have the chance to test some of the material that the ACCC had relied on in making its decision.
There was a whole interlocutory thing in that case about getting access to new materials and cross-examining witnesses, and the tribunal decided that it only needed to look at one extra report.
Yeah, here in the ANZ Suncorp review, it wasn't such a big deal. The tribunal allowed quite a few new documents, and in the end, it overturned the decision and authorised the acquisition.
So, unlike the ACCC, the tribunal was satisfied that the deal wouldn't substantially lessen competition.
Yeah, it said that the market for home loans was conducive to coordination, but it was actually becoming less so, including because of the rise of mortgage brokers and new lenders like Macquarie.
Yeah, they called Macquarie a maverick lender. And people are now talking about there being a big five instead of the big four banks, which we've had for as long as anyone can remember.
Yeah, but the critical thing was the tribunal found that the risk of coordination wouldn't be materially affected by the merger or any of the other scenarios the ACCC had identified.
Yeah, the ACCC have said that the tribunal's decision demonstrates the checks and balances of an administrative merger approval process, which seems to be a veiled or maybe not so veiled reference to the merger reform debate that we're having at the moment.
It does, but what we have right now is a bit different from what the ACCC is proposing. It's voluntary for a start, and I think that has some implications for the test and the burden of proof.
And there's an administrative element, but ultimately it's a judicial enforcement model. If the ACCC decides not to authorise and the parties go ahead anyway, the ACCC would have to take them to court and prove a breach of the law.
Yeah, and that'd be a pretty bold move for the parties, and it might never actually happen in practice. But even the possibility is going to factor into the ACCC's decisions, like they've said, and that's going to impose an extra level of discipline on them.
Yeah, it does seem like there's always a silver lining for the ACCC at the moment. If they win a case, that's great, but if they lose one, there's always an argument for change.
Yeah, they're very glass half full right now. They've also just released an ex post review of three more mergers, which they approved in 2019 and 2020. Two under the informal clearance process, and also the ACCC's first ever merger authorisation under the current framework.
The review found that market dynamics post-transaction are hard to predict. Remedy outcomes can vary, and outcomes aren't always consistent with expectations. That last one kind of applies to everything in life, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a good one to remember. In the Bauer Pacific Magazines merger, the ACCC said that the whole industry was in decline, and the merged entity would be constrained by online content providers. And according to the ex post review, that's exactly what happened.
Who would have thought that?
Hardly a new idea, you think?
I mean, that's life, isn't it?
Do you think anyone's going to recognise that those were some of Australia's most popular print magazines for like decades?
I don't know. Let's take five to remember them as they were.
Let's do that. In the ANZ Terminals GrainCorp merger, the ACCC had expected that the merged body would be constrained by the threat of expansion from other terminals, especially after an undertaking that reserved land for those other operators. But the ex-post review said that hadn't happened and that there were other barriers to expansion that hadn't been addressed.
But in the AP EGA's automotive holdings authorisation, the remedies did appear to have addressed the ACCC's concerns.
Yeah, this was an undertaking to divest all of AP EGA's car dealerships in the Newcastle and Hunter regions, which was the only place where the ACCC really had concerns. So again, not surprising that that had been effective.
So the ACCC still hasn't conducted any ex-post reviews of mergers that it opposed.
No, and it goes into some detail about why it hasn't. It says too little time or too much time has passed to offer any relevant insights. Where a merger hasn't gone ahead, the actual market developments aren't going to shed much light on the ACCC's predictions. And where the court or tribunal has allowed the merger, those decisions have been based on factors that can't really be tested through ex-post review.
Well, I guess these reviews are still useful. They can help us understand how the ACCC might consider claims or predictions for the future and the kind of undertakings they'll be likely to accept.
They can, but they do only tell part of the story because it is so hard to evaluate mergers that the ACCC has ended up opposing.
They've said they'll keep conducting ex-post reviews regardless of whether the government adopts changes to the merger process too.
Yep, but they do say that the results of the review may be relevant to that merger process inquiry.
Of course. What else is happening?
Well, the federal court has handed down its second highest fine for criminal cartel conduct after Bingo Industries and Aussie Skips and their former CEOs pleaded guilty to agreeing to raise the prices of the demolition waste services in Sydney by up to 25%.
So have you used Bingo or Aussie Skips for demolition waste services, Matt?
I haven't. This isn't like my roof guy in the Slate Roofing cartel of a few years ago. But you do see those skips and trucks all over the place.
You do. And here Bingo was fined $30 million, while Aussie Skips got $7 million. So what was the difference there?
Basically, Bingo's annual turnover was a lot higher than Aussie Skips, so the maximum penalty under the old triple threat formula was about $40 million for each offence for Bingo and just $10 million for Aussie Skips.
Aha. Uh-huh. So under the new triple threat, the maximum would be at least $50 million per offence for both of them.
It would. Apparently, Bingo were the instigators here. They set up the critical meeting at a cafe in Belfield, but they didn't have to twist any arms by the sound of things. Bingo pleaded guilty before Aussie Skips, so it got more of a discount, and they each wound up with a similar proportion of their maximum penalties.
And each of their CEOs was sentenced to a period of imprisonment to be served as an intensive correction order. So that's a supervised release with community service.
It is. Bingo's CEO has 2 years of that, including 400 hours of community service and a fine of $100,000. And Aussie Skip's CEO has 18 months, including 300 hours and $75,000. And they're both banned from managing corporations for 5 years.
Interesting. So nobody's actually gone to jail for cartel offences in Australia.
No, but it feels like they're getting pretty close. If you're sentenced to prison for more than 2 years, you can't get an intensive correction order, so you're probably looking at jail time. So I do think these sentences are starting to focus the mind, as we talked about with Liana Witt a couple of episodes ago.
And this is Justice Whitney, who's also imposed what had been the three highest penalties for criminal cartel offences, all of them in relation to motor vehicle cargo shipping.
Yeah, he imposed penalties of $34.5 million, $25 million and $24 million on the three shipping lines in question. Justice Whitney has written and spoken a lot about criminal cartel sentencing, as well as being, of course, the patron saint of our competition law-themed cryptic crossword, whether he knows it or not.
Or not. And our own Simon Mose and Owen Fishbein have a really interesting paper out soon about Justice Whitney and the Pattinson case that could result in a schism between civil and criminal cartel penalties.
Yep, and that'll be in the next edition of the Australian Journal of Competition and Consumer Law.
Not the Competition and Consumer Law Journal?
No, this is like the Judean People's Front and the People's Front of Judea.
Ah, splitters. Time for one more?
Well, after all our talk about Willy Wonka and the chocolate cartel.
Yeah, that's three episodes now and counting.
So far. After all that, there's some news from France where chocolate maker Chocolat de Neuville has been fined 4 million euros for what sounds a lot like a chocolate cartel, according to the Autorité de la Concurrence.
Not the Autorité Chalamet.
No, not that one. The Autorité found that for 13 years, Chocolat de Neuville's arrangements with its franchisees limited the areas where they could operate and prohibited the sale of chocolates by mail order or online.
Wait, isn't that how franchise systems work?
It can be, and here there could well be an exclusive dealing exception. But according to the Autorité, this went beyond what was necessary to maintain that franchise system, and it unreasonably restricted competition and the commercial freedom of the resellers.
Can this be appealed to a tribunal or a court?
It can be appealed to the court, but in the meantime, the fine still has to be paid.
Well, I'm sure we'll keep an eye on whether the fine is appealed.
We will. Meanwhile, in Wonka consumer protection news, police have been called to a near-empty warehouse in Glasgow after event organisers House of Illuminati advertised an immersive Wonka experience using AI-generated text and images which promised cat-cacating live performances, Karchi tons, Exasa Day lollipops, and a passisade of sweet teats.
Oh, that does sound enchernerining. But I'm guessing it was full of typos and wasn't officially licensed by the Wonka people?
It was not licensed. It cost £35 and turned out to be a near-empty warehouse with a single bouncy castle, a few banners stuck to the walls, and some actors paid to be Oompa Loompas with no props to work with, and crucially, no chocolate.
Well, I'd definitely say that doesn't match the description, but it's hard to imagine what would, actually.
It is. It also wasn't fit for purpose or a satisfactory quality. Everyone's been offered a refund, apparently, hopefully in spendable rather than edible form.
All right. So is that it for Wonka?
Almost. There's been a bit of confusion about the Wonka and antitrust connection and some speculation on social media that the Assistant Minister for Competition and podcast guest Dr. Andrew Lee may have been inspired by this podcast when he made reference to the impressive prequel recently.
Like when he moved the second reading of the bill that will allow consumer groups to make designated complaints or super complaints to the ACCC?
For example. But I think this is a case of great minds occasionally thinking like the lesser minds that produce competition law podcasts, because Dr. Lee actually had a piece in the Daily Telegraph about the chocolate cartel a few days before our podcast came out.
He did. And it actually turns out that people have been writing about the chocolate cartel since the first trailer was released last year, including former White House advisor Tim Wu.
Yeah, and also Spencer Webber Waller, who's written a couple of great papers about antitrust in popular culture, including film, television, theatre and fiction.
Oh, like Antitrust, which isn't about antitrust?
Yeah, but also The Informant with Matt Damon, which was based on the real-life lysine price-fixing cartel.
Oh, yeah, which a future regulator and I took some clients to see at the Open Air Cinema a few years ago.
But it was a great event.
It was.
Also, Demolition Man, which is set in a dystopian future where every restaurant is now a Taco Bell, the only ones to survive the devastating franchise wars.
Mm. But isn't Spencer Webber Waller the motto of the Olympics?
Oh, no, that's faster, higher, stronger.
Oh, well, actually, now that's faster, higher, stronger together.
Oh, no, you're right.
I once went to the World Masters Games and our team slogan was older, fatter, slower. But you're probably thinking of Carrie from Sex and the City?
Oh, I think that's Sarah Jessica Parker. You may mean the 1970 epic about Pearl Harbor.
Oh no, that's Tora, Tora, Tora. You might mean the Liverpool fan anthem sung at Chelsea in the Carabao Cup final recently.
I'm pretty sure that's LA, LA, LA.
It is.
You might mean what Ben Stein calls out to the classroom of Chicago school students in the classic John Hughes film.
Bueller, Bueller, Bueller.
So, we may not have been the first to recognise the competition and consumer law implications of the Wonka movie, but we are the ones who really ran them into the ground.
As always. But Moye, you recently hosted a forum on ESG sports and human rights at our office here in Sydney.
I did. Off the back of the Women's World Cup, we took the opportunity to fill our conference room with good sorts, including our two panellists, Ray Lindsay, who is the co-chair of the Business and Human Rights Lawyers Association, fairly new global body that this law firm is a member of, and Ilona Miller is our lead climate change and sustainability partner here at GNT. So we unpacked ESG's global trends, corporate sustainability developments in Europe, and the unfolding impacts here in Australia. I started by asking Ray Lindsay to give us the lowdown on the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights.
Let's take a listen.
Guiding Principles have been around since 2011, as I'm sure you all know. They're not legally binding. And for a long time, when I've been practicing in this space, there's very much been the, what's this got to do with lawyers? And you need to just get out of this space because you're just going to create problems. The guiding principles are starting to be reflected more in hard law. So the area is becoming much more of concern to legal practitioners. And that's right across the complete spectrum of both industries in which our clients are operating, but also across the full spectrum of what clients are asking lawyers to advise them on. So from the integration of policies and governance, the intersections with climate change and environment, for example, into business transactions, sustainable finance, for example, into dispute resolution. So it really does cover the entire space. And that involves a due diligence process. The great beauty of the guiding principles is recognizing this responsibility, but it's taken familiar concepts of due diligence to describe the way in which human rights due diligence can be incorporated into enterprise-wide risk management. It was really about plugging governance gaps that exist between what's legally binding and recognizing that businesses should respect human rights even when legally rights may not be protected on the ground. So it's about going above and beyond, identifying the impacts that your business and your business relationships may have on human rights and taking appropriate actions to address that, depending on whether you identify that you're causing or contributing to an impact or are linked to it through your value chains. That due diligence model, which is outlined in the guiding principles, is really interesting and different for businesses because it's very much about focusing on the impacts to people. And so the primary focus is not necessarily on the risks to the business, which would be dealt with alongside that. Now, that model has been taken up also by the OECD in their guidelines for multinational enterprises, which have just recently had some revisions made. So that incorporates the human rights due diligence model into the OECD guidelines and applies it across responsible business conduct areas, including, for example, the environment. Now, interestingly, pillar one of the guiding principles is about state duties, which is about regulating business behaviors so that they won't impact on, say, adversely on human rights. Policy and legislation in this area started off with transparency type measures. So the initial focus was really on, let's make businesses say what they're doing in these areas. What are they doing to address modern slavery risks in their businesses or their supply chains? But that was very much about reporting and not necessarily mandating the behaviors that would allow you to do these things properly. What we're seeing in Europe in particular, and this started in France and Germany, but now there is a European proposal for a corporate sustainability due diligence directive. That model will apply mandatory human rights due diligence as modeled on the OECD guidelines and the UN guiding principles. And companies will be required to establish policies, processes, due diligence processes, and report and account for their impacts in the human rights and environmental areas. The interesting thing about the legislation is that it is very closely modeled on these due diligence approaches. And so very much focused on what are your impacts on people, what are your impacts on the environment. It's going to be interesting to see how successfully one can legislate around what have been these soft law standards. But that's certainly the trend. And I know that you've recently had a report on your Modern Slavery Act here and how that might be made more robust by introducing new due diligence processes based on the UN Guiding Principles model. So what we see is this evolution of new mandatory requirements that businesses should actually do what a lot of businesses have already been doing under the soft law standards, but putting that into legal obligation.
Can I ask, how is this being received in Europe and the UK? Are boards starting to really worry about this now? Are they anxious about it? Are they welcoming it?
There's an interesting mix, I think. There have been a lot of big businesses who are taking things like modern slavery and supply chains really seriously and doing a lot of great work. They were keen that there'd be at least a minimum threshold that all businesses would have to meet so that there'd be a level playing field and they wouldn't be the only ones who were doing due diligence and trying to work with their suppliers to increase conditions on the ground for people who were affected by things like forced labor or child labor. So there was this, a lot of businesses wanting that to be created. I think that's true in Europe as well. We've had a lot of industry associations come out in favor of not just the new mandatory due diligence, but also civil liability provisions. So being held to account where companies get it wrong and there are consequences which cause damage to people. So there's been quite a lot of vocal support investors as well. And one of the interesting features of this legislation is that it will directly impact a lot of non-EU headquartered businesses who have a fair amount of business in the EU. So it's that sort of level playing field. And then a desire for certainty. I think this is one of the big question marks about, because the EU is taking quite a granular approach as to what these expectations are and how much gets put into the legislation. It remains to be seen how much of that creates certainty or, similar to the French law, creates quite a lot of litigation around what does this provision of this law mean for business and are they going far enough? So that will shake itself out. So that's a long-winded way of saying I think a lot of businesses are in favour, but whether the legislation that it results will actually meet up to those expectations and satisfy that level playing field and certainty aspect of it remains to be seen.
It's very interesting. I mean, businesses always, they don't want it to be a race to the bottom so that the worst behaved people get the biggest advantage in the market. So yeah. if it does level out those things competitively, it'll be a good thing. Ilona, may I turn to you and ask where we are at in Australia with this? Because nobody's looking at legislation in Australia to do that, but there are other pieces of legislation around and there are other pressures, of course, on businesses to be more ESG conscious.
Yeah, well, I might start in terms of modern slavery, because I think this is the area where we are actually seeing the greatest advances in terms of the approach to integrating due diligence processes into thought leadership in law reform. The current Modern Slavery Act here in Australia doesn't have that obligation to actually implement due diligence practices. What it does is it's a reporting or a transparency piece of legislation that talks about how companies describe what their due diligence activities are, but there's not a duty to implement and act upon the results of that due diligence. And so one of the key recommendations of the review into the Modern Slavery Act was that there be incorporated a positive obligation on reporting entities to have a due diligence system in place and to explain the activities associated with that system in their modern slavery statement. So this is a very small step to start thinking about how due diligence frameworks can be developed and implemented and reported on in a way that will actually be meaningful in terms of being able to look at systems and processes and what is actually making a difference in practice. And that's going to be quite significant if that recommendation is adopted. The other component of the review of the Modern Slavery Act is the recommendation that there be civil penalty provisions as well. So if you are failing to have a due diligence system in place, that is potentially going to be a civil penalty offence under the modern slavery legislation again, if those recommendations are picked up and implemented. So I think we're seeing small steps in quite a narrow and constrained space around modern slavery to bring in this approach to mandatory due diligence requirements, but it hasn't permeated more broadly within the Australian law reform process. And that's something that I think we will be looking very closely to what Europe is doing to see how that could in fact be picked up in respect of Australian law reform processes. Australia does have very strong laws across a number of the different areas of ESG, but my observation is that they tend to be quite siloed and focused on compliance issues rather than bringing in a more integrated and holistic view that really focuses on issues related to identification of risk and opportunity, looking at the broader governance frameworks and how this approach to ESG risks and opportunities are then reflected in business strategy. And so I think that's an area where we need to be thinking more about how we look at these issues rather than just in the environmental space in respect of pollution or contamination or waste, and social space around labour or discrimination is how do we look at this in terms of overall business performance. And at the moment where there's no mandatory obligation to do that.
Well, they say if you want to improve something, measure it. Mm-hmm. And it's along a similar path to Europe, but we're nowhere near as far down that path, and we'll be watching that closely. One of the other things that's developing in parallel with the law is a set of community expectations around what we should do, what we should stand for, because there are a whole lot of pressures on boards and on businesses that go beyond what their lawyers tell them they have to do. They have to make decisions about what they should do rather than just do what they must do. How are those pressures playing out in ESG right now?
I think the environment has changed a lot in that respect. And obviously, there's a lot more focus now on purpose, you know, what is value, long-term views, role in society, and how you articulate what the company's overall purpose is and what it does stand for. And I think one of the tensions has been how companies articulate that and then ensuring that they actually live up to what they say they're doing and what do you take positions on. So it's quite easy to be reactive to something that might be in the news today and come out strong on that, but then not necessarily follow through on it. So I think there is, you know, increasingly efforts to hold companies to account for that kind of things where they don't necessarily walk the talk. Obviously, there's a lot of commitments around the sustainable development goals, et cetera, or within particular contexts, particular issues. So Black Lives Matter in the United States. I think it's just really important once the board is considering what the values and purpose of the organization are, having taken account of the stakeholder views and increasingly very much listening to the voice of communities, society general, employees in particular, in order to articulate and carry through that, what does the company stand for? But real difficulties, obviously, in then living that, as I said, but also in the political arena. How far do you go on particular issues which may actually be very divisive within society, and there's not easy black and whites? So that one, I think, is the one that creates the greatest difficulty for organizations right now, obviously in the States where nobody can mention ESG because, you know, in some states companies are being shut out of procurement processes, if they have climate strategies, et cetera, et cetera. So that's showing this sort of pendulum swing of public opinion, and also when you have very polarized political views. So I think that's difficult for companies to do. I think it's really important to always understand what you're saying and why you're saying it, and making sure that you're actually following it through, which is really difficult with, you know, creating the tone from the top, the culture within the organization, and then ensuring that you have all the structures in place to make sure that that's lived through the entire fabric of the organization, and always being able to justify what you do by reference to it. Do you want to say something about shareholder activism? Yeah. Because obviously that's a big deal here as well as in the
UK. Yeah, look, I mean, I would start with those trends away from sort of shareholder primacy to stakeholder capitalism. We've heard a lot, particularly coming out of people like Larry Fink in his annual letters to shareholders, about the importance of looking at the relationship between a company and its stakeholders and not just its investors and shareholders. And it's critically important to be having a look at what is the purpose of a company and also looking at what is its long-term enterprise value. This is where some of that backlash is coming in the US around woke capitalism. But ultimately, what a company is doing when it starts to really take into account the interests of its stakeholders is looking at how it will actually drive mutually beneficial relationships that will ultimately deliver financial value as well as impact value for the company. And also we're seeing an expectation from stakeholders around the information that they want to see around a company's performance, not only financial performance, but also performance in respect of more qualitative non-financial metrics related to impact. And this comes to the heart of ultimately concepts of the social license to operate. And we've had a number of examples here in Australia where poor performance has really undermined that. You know, the examples in the mining sector around impacts on particularly female workers, both in terms of discrimination and sexual harassment, that's led to quite significant investigations, reports, and ultimately processes for law reform. Similarly, in respect of cultural heritage and the Juukan Gorge incident, that fundamentally undermined the mining company's social license and has also, again, led to law reform off the back of that in a reactive way to improve cultural heritage laws in Western Australia. So I think what we see is an interesting sort of dynamic in terms of the pressures from various stakeholders. And I've been sort of focusing on, you know, investors in the wider community. But also when we look at stakeholders in terms of customer pressures, employee preferences as well, all of this is driving a change in behaviour. And in some cases, that is also driving law reform as well.
A lot of organisations must be doing ESG strategies and planning now. And for each organisation, it will mean something different. Ilona and Ray, can you give us examples of what you're seeing in the world of corporates and clients who are taking on these challenges and saying, well, we haven't had to pay a lot of attention to it now. It seemed like a voluntary kind of charitable thing to do if you wanted to be nice to people and be nice to the planet. But now that we're much more serious about it, how are we going to set ourselves goals and how are we going to hold ourselves to those things?
Yeah, I might start with a couple of observations of what I've seen. And a lot of it has been led by climate, but also picks up on other sort of components of S&G as well. But the first thing we're seeing is a number of companies are, you know, the starting point is a materiality assessment, actually looking at the business and determining what are those material ESG issues and looking at that through the lens of not only what is financial materiality, but also impact materiality and what is relevant to the stakeholders of the organization. And then taking from that materiality assessment, the top half a dozen issues. You know, you can say that you're aligned with the UN Sustainable Development Goals or other sort of frameworks, but ultimately you're not going to be able to tick off, you know, all of those goals. So you've got to determine what is actually materially relevant to the business and your stakeholders. And then from there, look at that through the lens of how you then develop your approach to risk analysis and assessment, and then also your strategy to respond to that. And a core component, as you say, also comes back to what are your targets and how are you measuring them? In the climate space, there's a really good framework that's been developed post the Paris Agreement called the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. That's now underpinning a lot of the way in which financial disclosures for other sustainability topics are being developed, including in respect of biodiversity and nature, and also sustainability more broadly. The recommendations of the TCFD, you know, start with essentially looking at what is your approach to governance, what is your approach to risk assessment and mitigation and management, then looking at strategy and then looking at metrics and targets and providing that lens through which you assess both risks but also opportunities to the business. And we're starting to see that embedded in now the sort of best practice recommendations of our corporate regulators. And indeed, that's sort of being picked up in respect of mandatory disclosure standards as well. I think that's the framework that we're starting to work with clients in respect of. So it's not just pure compliance aspects. It's much broader in terms of the integration of both risk and strategy into those considerations of ESG issues.
In this area, there's so much happening and organizations don't have really the resources. So really important to get the governance right and make sure you do have the right people in the right places doing those jobs. But in the market, there just isn't necessarily the capacity. And so there's a huge just expertise drought, I think, in terms of staffing a lot of this to get it done properly.
That's interesting. Job opportunities for people.
And as you mentioned, Lone, a lot of the thinking around the governance now is disclosures driven. But the markets have moved a lot faster in terms of ambitions and the business opportunities than the regulator has kept up in any way in relation to disclosures, but also in terms of what it's doing in relation to, say, greenwashing or regulation around sustainable finance, et cetera. When you look at what's happening in the disclosure space, you can certainly see what's coming in terms of what you're going to have to do there. Important to have the governance to allow you to drive that. But as you said, Moya, it's then very easy for some things to fall through the gaps because you're so focused on filling in the columns in a disclosure sheet, which people are spending, you know, their entire days and months doing at the moment. And other things just get falls through the cracks, not least on the double impact side, which is how we matching up the opportunity and the risk side of things and making sure the governance is right. Whole lot of expertise in the sustainability functions who aren't necessarily talking the same language as their disclosures counsel or their in-house lawyers. So there's a real risk of miscommunications and therefore the disclosures just going wrong. So that's recognizing that this is a really cross-disciplinary area, that you need the right expertise within your organization with the various functions communicating and the governance working horizontally and vertically to get that all right is really key. And so I think it really is a challenge because, you know, in the climate space, a lot of that's science-based, but the goalposts are constantly moving about what you're going to have to report on, what the right science targets at, what are, you know, mitigants and what are, you know, poor options. The whole space is just moving so fast that it really is a struggle to try and keep up with it. I think a lot of organizations are now doing gap analyses internally to see where things could be falling through the cracks. Because I think that really is a risk in this area just because of the fact that it is completely cross-cutting. And now part and parcel of just for everything that every business is doing.
So can I ask you for your predictions for the next 3 to 5 years in the ESG space? If we were having this conversation in 3 to 5 years' time, what would we be saying has been done and what would we be thinking the future challenges are?
For Australia, I'd like to think that in 5 years' time, we will be taking a much more comprehensive approach to integrating the UN guiding principles across a much broader range of areas instead of it solely being sort of focused in quite narrow pieces of legislation. I think moving towards the work around an overarching directive and putting those broader obligations on businesses in respect of their diligence frameworks is something I'd love to see us move towards.
A more coherent, sort of cohesive approach. Yeah. Right?
I hope we don't lose our ambition. I mean, I think you know, there's a real role. States really need to step up in terms of regulation and the interdependence of everything and thinking about what's actually effective and making it work. So transition pathways and how we achieve that on a global basis while being mindful of the human rights impacts and the need for leaving nobody behind across borders. There's huge expectations on business, particularly with respect to, you know, investments and movements of capital, but states really need to give the guidance to make it work and have effective laws that will encourage that in the right ways.
So it's an alliance between states, businesses and individuals who make up communities' expectations.
Yeah, and right now I just think with geopolitics, there's lots of excuses that can be found to step back the ambition. And I think a lot of that political swing is creating a certain retrenchment with some areas of business. So I just hope we can, because we need to save the planet.
What a great panel. I have heard it said that in the coming years, the hotspots in regulatory growth will centre on the environment and on social responsibility.
You heard it here first.
But did I miss the bits about sport?
Oh man, I thought you'd never ask. We had lots of other speakers at our forum, some of whom have been on the front line of applying the UN guiding principles to the world of sport. So we'll be dropping a special bonus edition soon with more fabulous guests, including someone who has one more World Cup winners' medal than I do and one more Olympic gold medal than you do, Matt.
Well, I'm going to hit subscribe and get it in my feed, and so should everybody else, because too much sport is never enough.
Too right. So, Matt, is it time for you to peer into your crystal ball?
Sure. Well, around the time that this episode drops, ACCC Chair Gina Cass-Gottlieb will be revealing the Commission's priorities for the 2024-25 financial year, and we'll be publishing our annual year in review and outlook for the coming year.
We're hearing that the competition review is about to send its recommendations to Treasury. So hopefully we'll see the government response to that. And we might even see the ACCC's response to the government's response. So what's all that going to look like?
It'll be interesting. I kind of feel like the Assistant Minister for Competition will be in favour of anything that'll be seen to reduce concentration. Mm-hmm. But the Treasurer may also be thinking about the role that mergers can play in dynamism and productivity. And he may be interested in a kind of middle path.
So that might involve a formal mandatory notification and suspensory process, which would address a lot of the ACCC's concerns and would deal with the overwhelming majority of mergers.
Yeah, and it might do that without changing the test to be applied or moving away from judicial enforcement towards an administrative decision model, at least for now. It might say, let's solve that problem of visibility and our priority in the international MJ context and use the information we get through that process to see what else needs to be done.
Well, either way, there'll be a big focus on law changes this coming year.
Yeah, the ACCC has really made a big push for the merger reforms, and we can expect that they'll now shift to some of the other changes that are under consultation.
Yeah, well, there's the ex ante regulation of digital platforms, where the ACCC chair has just written a piece in the AFR reminding us of the ACCC's concerns.
Yeah, and then there's the related but broader prohibition on unfair trading practices.
Oh, unfitees.
Unfitees. And that's going to be particularly important given the rising Aussie lives and the ACCC's focus on protecting vulnerable consumers.
And the team have put together a great update on the latest in consumer law enforcement, which we'll link to in the show notes along with other relevant links.
Shop Talk.
That's the one. Remember, you can email us at edge@gtlaw.com.au.
And we've got some great guests still to come, including Andrew Lowe on the latest in digital platforms and payments, and counsel to the chair of the ABA's antitrust section, and Catherine Fay on sustainability. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell your friends.
Till next time, this was The Competitive Edge with Gilbert and Tobin.